Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, the latest on junk food and those energy drinks. Also, for those who would like to improve their digestive health, I'll give you some steps to do that, not difficult to do. And also, eating yogurt can ease the symptoms of depression. And saffron, a safe and effective treatment for postpartum depression. All these are major university studies published in peer-reviewed journals. Plus, from our public health segment today, examples to show how big pharma cares more about profits than people. Paul Phillips' new paradigm. The guest I'm going to have in the second part of the program is probably one of the most qualified to talk on this topic of anyone, and yet I haven't heard him in any of the media. He is Ray McGovern. He is going to talk about the liberal democratic establishment and the memo. Why is he so qualified? Because he was in the CIA as an analyst for 27 years under seven presidential administrations. Also, he was responsible for preparing the president's daily brief, which is a one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisor. So he was in the loop on everything. And he had a specialization in Russia. So we're going to talk with him about who's right about the memo. Is it a big nothing? Simply a way of obstructing even more the current administration's complicit arrangements with Russia? Or is there no arrangements with Russia, and they are complicit in doing a cover-up of their own misdeeds? We'll find that out today. Also, if time permits today, I'm going to play an audio clip that I appreciated, and I'm sure some of the people in this audience will as well, involving how we're teaching, what we're teaching, and why it's not working. Early this morning, I took my first call at 5 o'clock, and it was from someone I know who's a professor. And this person said that they were at a turning point in their life. They have virtually spent their entire adult life in academia, but are now so fed up because most students, don't want to study. And they're distracted by so much other stimulation that this teacher can't compete. And I guess was asking my insight as to why I stopped teaching this year. For the first time in 35 years, I'm no longer teaching. And I explained that I'm not going to stop teaching. I believe that we have a responsibility, if we can share insights with other people, to do so. It's just, who are we teaching to? How are we reaching those people? And what is the responsibility of the person who is a learner to show that they appreciate the time and energy you're taking to prepare their lessons? Whether they accept or reject them is up to them. But there should be a cooperation, a partnership in education. And for many, not all, but for the majority, it's missing. As a result, we are graduating functional illiterates. That everyone I know in education agrees upon. So I gave a suggestion of how this person could use the internet and teach not out inside the college, give up the sanctuary, give up the tenure, give up those comforts and securities, but then get back to really helping people who want to learn and are willing to pay attention. So you're going to hear a short clip called about education today. So that's our program. Let's begin. This is from Northern Kentucky University, published in The Teenage Brain, Birth Defects Research. And it talks about junk food and those energy drinks that you see advertised everywhere. And the popularity of energy drinks and junk food might have unique risks for teenagers who consume them on a regular basis, especially during the latter stages of brain development. Now, these are just two of the factors potentially affecting teen brain development examined in this new issue. And the scientific journal issued the insight about taurine, caffeine, and energy drinks, reviewing the risks of adolescent brain. That's the title of the article. And it said it's not good. It said it's quite simply, sometimes these energy drinks are taken with caffeine among teenagers, and it can end up impacting negatively the brain development. Quote, our review indicates that we don't know enough about the effects of high consumption of energy drinks and ingredients found in them at this critical time in mammalian brain development. Our recent findings in adolescent and young adult mice exposed to high taurine levels indicate there can be adverse effects on learning and memory. Okay. And then throw in the alcohol and you got a double negative. But they're not the only ones doing research on this. There's also a Dr. Amy Reichlet at the University of Melbourne, also looking at junk food and how it affects teenage brains. Because, quote, the key neurotransmitter systems in the brain responsible for inhibition and reward signaling are still developing during the teen years, existing primarily on junk food could negatively affect decision-making, increase reward-seeking behavior, and influence poor eating habits throughout adulthood. So, and there are others. I'm looking at several. The neurobiology of substance use on the adolescent brain, all these articles. So the bottom line is this. Let's put this into lay language that we can all understand. Our brain doesn't stop developing at 6 or 2 or 9. It's still developing into our 20s. And in those parts of the brain where you desire to have an energy drink and you fulfill that desire, you're creating, in effect, a new conditioned brain that is adverse to your own health because you're more likely to take unnecessary risks and you're more likely to end up having learning defects, memory defects, as early as teenage years. So if you're already having memory and learning problems as a teenager because what you're doing, imagine that how that's going to play out when you go to college or when you're out of college in the workforce. Also, it impacts our desire to be rewarded. So if we feel we deserve an energy drink, we deserve a certain feeling, a certain euphoria, that's no different than cocaine or methamphetamine or any of the other drugs out there that give people a kind of like crack will give you about a 4-minute blissful state and then a big come down. And then people think they deserve that state again. And that's how addictive behavior happens. For those of you who want to improve your gut, the good bacteria in it, and you ask, how do I do that? Where do I start? Okay. Digestive enzymes. Why? Because digestive enzymes assist in breaking down food. They reduce inflammation, and they regulate your immune responses that could otherwise have damaged tissues. So you always take your digestive enzymes at the end of a meal, by the way. And two of the best would be bromelain from pineapple and papain from papaya. So nice would be a cup of papaya and pineapple combined that you eat at the end of a meal. And that would help. Also, eating more raw fruits and vegetables is good for creating healthier balance of digestive enzymes in the gut. Because all those fruits and vegetables are loaded with enzymes. And apples, spinach, pineapples, carrots, avocados, grapefruits, tomatoes, they are super good for you. Then you hear me talk about probiotics. They're really good for your gut. Now, naturally occurring gut bacteria, such as the bifidobacteria and lactobacillus, enhance intestinal barrier function and help to suppress bad things, the pathogens, the viruses, the yeast, the molds. And friendly good bacteria strengthens your immune system, enhances good digestion. Also, by having more fiber in the diet, I suggest between 40 and 50 grams a day. Exercising every day also is a part of that. So exercising, drinking lots of good, clean water, and purify your water, but get clean water. Water out the tap is not clean. eating more fermented foods would be terrific. And right now, the pickled vegetables, this raw sauerkraut, the miso soup, the tempeh, the yogurt, the kefirs, kombucha, those are all good. And chew your food, ideally 20 times per mouthful. Take your time, and remember, anytime you take antibiotics, they're going to destroy your good bacteria and colonize bad bacteria. And also, there was a article from University of Virginia about eating yogurt and how that could ease the symptoms of depression. That's because the makeup of the yogurt, and that would include not just dairy yogurt, but also vegan yogurt. And it also has good probiotics. And once again, there's many studies showing a relationship between good bacteria in your gut and a reduction in symptoms of depression. Saffron. Most people don't use saffron for simple reason. It's so expensive. If you ever see it, it looks like a little orangish piece of thread. It's about even thinner than thread. And that little herb is one of the most powerful healing herbs in all of nature. And Mashhad University of Medical Sciences did some research on this, especially for postpartum depression, meaning the mood disorders that affect as many as 1 in 7 new mothers. Generally, it's characterized by deep mood swings, low energy, and loss of interest in daily activities. And what we find is that this could be due to a sudden drop in estrogen and progesterone that occurs in a woman's body immediately after giving birth. And currently, the only approved medical treatments for postpartum depression are talk therapy and psychiatric medications. Talk therapy is fine and can help people. Psychiatric meds cannot, because it's also going to interfere with a mother's wishes to breastfeed and have only healthy ingredients come through. Every one of those psychiatric meds is going to go right through into the breast milk and hinder your having these medicine metabolites into the developing child. You don't want that. So the key here is saffron. And saffron is one of the world's most unique spices. It's a very delicate flavor. It kind of has like a sweet hay-like golden hue to it. And it's used in traditional dyes, but it's also been used as a medicine for over 4,000 years. And they found that saffron, in a double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial, was able to make a statistically significant difference on the Beck Depression Inventory Second Edition scale against placebo. They took it for 8 weeks, 15 milligrams a day, which is a small dose of the powder. But the group that took saffron, listen carefully, had a 96% remission rate from postpartum depression. I repeat, the group of women who took 15 milligrams per day of a powdered saffron had a 96% remission rate for postpartum depression. Wow. That is tremendous. And there's also a 2014 meta-analysis entitled Saffron for Depression, a systematic review of clinical studies and examination of underlying antidepressant mechanism of action. They looked at 6 separate studies on saffron for treating depression, not just postpartum, just regular depression. And they compared it with antidepressant medications. Saffron was found to have similar efficacy with no harmful side effects. In fact, saffron's antidepressant properties have been attributed to its serotonergic, antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, neuroendocrine, and neuroprotective effects. So, if you're depressed, saffron is just one of the many things that we could use. Also, this goes against what the latest 2 generations of parents have been told, and that is encouraging risk-taking in children can reduce the prevalence of childhood anxiety. This is from Macquarie University for Emotional Health in the Netherlands. And the new international study suggests that parents who employ challenging parent behavioral methods, active physical and verbal behaviors that encourage children to push their limits, break through, are likely protecting their children from developing childhood anxiety disorder. And that's important, especially in preschool-age children, and show that the parents who scored higher in their methods, encouraging their kids to push their limits in all areas, to a greater extent had children who were less at risk of exhibiting anxiety disorder symptoms. So something to think about, because we have over-coddled, we have over-encouraged kids not to take risks, instead to play it safe. And certainly there are good reasons for not doing anything. It could harm someone. But we're talking about challenges in all areas, like how about challenging a child to clean up their room every day, make their bed every day, to make sure that they're putting everything away, that when they study, challenge yourself. Go the extra half hour of sitting there reading before you stop reading. Challenge yourself. Make a new friend. Make a friend of a person of a different race, a different ethnicity, someone that challenges the social constructs of your own belief systems, that they have to be very similar, if not identical, in their religion or their politic to you. In other words, let kids who have no problems commingling and accepting everyone, kids don't care what color you are, what your background is, what your religion is, they just find everything curious and interesting. They still want to be your friend. There was once a statement, it's been attributed to Einstein, but I don't believe I can't find yet where he said it, that all children are born geniuses, and then our educational system controls the kids so much that they lose that capacity for the adventure of continuing to create, especially if you're made to feel that everything you do is an unnecessary competition and you never want to feel bad. Hence, you should be rewarded for just showing up in life. Well, who's going to take a risk? So, just something to think about. Also, from Yale University School of Medicine, published in Science Signaling, aging, meaning over the age of 27, impairs the immune system's response to the flu virus in multiple ways, weakening resistance in older adults. And the research reveals why older people are at an increased risk of illness and death from the flu. Quote, influenza virus mortality is the highest in older adults. This study sheds light on a mechanism that underlines this impaired antiviral response. Okay, I agree with that. Then you're going to suggest that a vaccine that also challenges the immune system, that has never proven its high efficacy, and also has people who died from the flu after they got their flu vaccine. But not once do you talk about what will help an older person fight the flu. Vitamin D, omega-3 fatty acids, quercetin, which has strong antiviral activity, vitamin C, black cumin seed oil, bee propolis, olive leaf extract, wild oregano oil, echinacea, patiarco, astragalus, manuka honey, green tea. All of those are known and proven to stimulate the immune system. That would have made the difference if they had used that insight. Also from Tulane University, published in the American Journal of Pathology, there were two papers actually, the other published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS One, talked about how Lyme bacteria survived 28-day course of antibiotic months after infection. And so what this means is that those Borrelia spirochetes, the bacteria that cause Lyme disease before and after antibiotic treatment in this study, that bacteria is still alive 28 days later. Well, whoa, you have a 28-day antibiotic program. For all intents and purposes, you've just destroyed the vast majority of gut, good gut biome, the good bacteria in your gut, and you make yourself extremely susceptible to secondary infections. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be doing a program in the very near future on a natural protocol for Lyme's disease. And also, that does not include antibiotics. From the Journal of Medicinal Food, it says, avoid drugs and surgery for prostate issues. Use flaxseed instead. Well, millions of men face prostate issues, and with treatment with drugs and surgery often making their problems worse, a new study reveals that simply eating flaxseed may be the best way to improve your symptoms and take back control of your health. And also this reduced urinary frequency, urgencies, nocturia, which is an abnormal frequency of nighttime urination, a decreased and intermittent force of stream help with that. So normally when people have problems with the prostate, they're having problems with their diet as well. And so this is just suggesting in this randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study, three groups of men, 45 to 75, with newly diagnosed BPH and an American Urological Association Symptom Index score of 13, were given either placebo or a lower high dose of lignin, L-I-G-N-I-N, rich flaxseed whole extract. I would have done it differently. I would not have given that. I would have given the flaxseed oil. Boy, did they miss this. But here's the irony. They missed it, and they still ended up good. So they end up with a 500 or 1,000 milligrams. That's just half a gram or a gram. That's tiny, of the lignans. Quote, in this study, supplementation with flaxseed whole extract provided greater relief than placebo in obstructive symptoms of BPH, such as sensation of incomplete bladder emptying, stopping and starting while urinating, weak urinary system, and straining while urinating. So it supported a substantial, significant increase in improvement. What do you think would have happened if they had used the flaxseed oil? But I'd have gone one better than that. I would have done, because I've worked with so many men with prostate conditions, one much better and much higher dose, a teaspoon of flaxseed oil, a teaspoon of coconut oil, and a teaspoon of the olive oil, and then a teaspoon of black cumin seed oil. Those four together, wow. An enormous difference. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 23 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I might mention now that one more way to make it really easy to hear this program every day at noon, no matter where you're at, is on your cell phone, you have a store. That's where you get your apps. We now have a PRN.FM app. PRN, Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM app. And that way you can get the app, and automatically you got us, it's crystal clear. If you don't have that, let me give you a number you can call every day if you're not about your computer or your radio. Write this down, please. 424-203-8046. 424-203-8046. And before we go to that audio segment, we're going to have some of your input from Elizabeth, who's on the line now. Hi, Elizabeth.
We have a comment, really, from a professor who's retired. He says, for over 50 years, he was a confirmed liberal, but he says that those in charge of our democratic process have betrayed our true liberal values. So now he's a progressive. He doesn't read the mainstream public, any mainstream publications, or watches the media, because he says it's all ideological propaganda. But he thanks you for looking for the truth outside of the existing paradigms. And then the second is from a gentleman called Robert. He says, even with people who are listening to you daily on the radio, and even that may well be friends of yours, and they're still not making changes to support good health practices. So his question is, how do people get out of this cognitive disconnect?
Elizabeth, are you familiar with the writer H. Somerset Maugham?
Yeah, well, I haven't read a lot of his things, but yeah.
Okay. He said it is dangerous to let the public behind the scenes. They are easily disillusioned, and then they are angry with you, for it was the illusion they loved. So on the one hand, people have the illusion that as long as they listen to a program on health, somehow, by a process of ethereal osmosis, they're going to become healthy. That if they watch an athletic event like yesterday's Super Bowl, they will become a part of that athletic energy. It's not true. You're either a passive spectator to life, or you are an intellectual, emotional spectator to life, in which case you sit comfortably and, most importantly, safely within your private domain, that little docile, and you can then argue to the world outside. You can take sides. On one side of the playing field, we have A. On the other side, we have B. And let them fight it out. That does not help you as a person. It's only when you evolve to a point where you're willing to look at what is reasonable and responsible for your own development, and then embrace it and become it. Because at the end of the day, creeds, screeds, the synonyms that we wrap ourselves in to allow us a greater identity than what we would have just as an individual are meaningless. It's what you have evolved in doing that represents who you are. So we have a world today, especially in America, where everyone wants to talk and very few people actually do. For example, how many people during the 2007 till 2014, at the height of the recession, we had over 7.5 million homes foreclosed on. That's about 28 million Americans made homeless. How many of those homeless people were asked by their neighbors where they had lived side by side or across the street for decades, whose kids went to school together, who enjoyed, outings and barbecue and swimming together in the season? Did a person go over and say, friend, I know that you're going through some difficulty. How can I help you? You didn't have that. It's as if seeing someone who has been attacked by a system or circumstances beyond their control are somehow pathogenic. We stay far from them. That's why in any establishment, they always take on the most popular, the most powerful advocate or dissident. Destroy them, in that all people of weaker constitutions and spiritual value will suddenly recess themselves back into nothingness. So we have to ask ourselves, what is the purpose of turning on the Gary Noll Show? It's not for amusement. It's not for entertainment. It's to be stimulated at an intellectual, emotional, and spiritual level, to hopefully ignite that passion to become proactive on the issues that are important for us to evolve as human beings. And then they're doing something that's not passively spectating life, but proactively engaged in it. Hope that answers the question.
Thank you. Good. Thank you.
Now we're going to go over and say hello to my guest. I want to give him a half hour today. He has a lot to say. He is Ray McGovern. I gave you his biographical information at the beginning of the program. He also works with Tell the World, an ecumenical Catholic publication house, and his opinion pieces have appeared in a lot of the different journals. He holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University. He has a background in Russian history and has graduated from Harvard Business School. And he also has a background in theology from Georgetown University. His website is raymcgovern.com. And he also writes for consortiumnews.com. Nice to have you with us today, Ray.
Thank you, Gary.
Ray, I'm going to ask you a long question and then stay quiet for a longer answer. Right now, people's heads are exploding. The corporate left, and I want to identify the corporate left as singularly and separate from the historical true liberal, as I would do the same for the historically true conservative versus the Republican Party. But what they're arguing is that the memo has no basis in reality. It's a big nothing. And it, in some way, is used by Trump to take away the energy of these different Mueller committees and others. I see it differently, and here's where my question is multifactorial and comes in. I don't just see a memo. I see a long history of abuse, not just by those at the top, but also by many of the rank and file, either complicit by intentional ignorance, which is something that we rarely discuss in our society, but I believe we should. In other words, if I work in an organization like the National Security Agency or the FBI or the CIA, do I have any moral responsibility for the actions that are taken upon by the people in that organization that I may be complicit in or enabling? I believe people do. But more often than not today, they fiend any, well, that wasn't me. I didn't run the agency. It was someone else's fault, not mine. Okay. You've been in the CIA. You were in the CIA for 27 years. So you had a firsthand seat to see the best and worst that an agency could be. So I decided to take a look at how many different books there are out there on the CIA, and not just about what is happening now, but its history, like Ghost Wars, the secret history of the CIA, The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Angleton, The Ghost at Langley by John Prados, The Politics of Heroin, in my opinion, the most complete book on how the CIA engaged in the global drug trade. It was by Alfred McCoy, and many others. There are dozens. I also found the same was true for the FBI. So once again, we're told all the FBI, they only have a few bad things that have happened and rare. No, the entire regime of J. Edgar Hoover was bad, and he was there for 48 years. He was a power to himself. And there are many books, The Secret of the FBI, Brimon Kessler, Enemies, A History of the FBI, Tim Weiner, The FBI, They Eat Their Young by William Allen Larch. That's really a good book, by the way. He's a former agent, career agent. And most of these were by career agents. The FBI war on Tupac Shakur and black leaders, U.S. intelligence murders, targeting of Malcolm X, etc. The threat matrix, the burglars, the FBI and religion, the FBI in Latin America, and on and on. There are dozens of books on both the FBI and the CIA, yet not once in any of these discussions has anyone said, shouldn't we stop for a moment and take a look at the Justice Department, the National Security Agency, the CIA, and the FBI, and its entirety? What's it made up of? What has been their policy? Have they been politicized? And if so, for how long? That's one part of the problem. We're talking as if they've never been politicized. That's what both sides are saying. Oh, I have great respect for everyone in the FBI except the top five people. Nonsense. But that if you've heard these dimwits on radio and television, that's what they're saying. The second part of this question is, who's behind these people? What would have been the motives? And there I see 1,500 newspapers, 1,100 magazines, 9,000 radio stations, 1,500 TV stations, 2,400 publishers, all owned by six corporations: GE, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS. And each of them owns places that create this fake news: Comcast, NBC, Universal Pictures, of New York Post, Wall Street Journal, Fox, ABC, ESPN, Pixar, Miramax, MTV, CNN, HBO, Showtime, all of the places where 90% of Americans get their information on everything are owned by six corporations. So shouldn't the question at least be a legitimate question? How politicized have these six corporations been, and then add in the more than 13,000 news outlets these six corporations control, because this is how we get our information. And lastly, why is it no one's actually asking what I consider the most important question? And that is, in the last election, if Clinton had been elected and everybody had bet that she would be, do you think that any of this would have come up today? Would there have been a change in our foreign policy with respect to Israel, with Saudi Arabia, that we just learned today, along with the United Arab Emirates, last June was going to invade Qatar? Qatar just announced that this morning when his foreign minister was talking about how close they came to being invaded. We would have supported Saudi Arabia in that invasion. That would have been one major problem in the Middle East, but also our support for Turkey, our support for the NATO, our support for the regime change in Libya. All these things Clinton supported. Now pull back and see who's around Clinton. See the Council on Foreign Relations, the 5,000 really elite people in our society and around the world who control our foreign policy. Then you look at the 400,000 corporations that are involved day to day in making money if a Clinton or another person with that same mindset, a neocon, is in power, who can be predictable, who can work with you, who you can do deals with. And now you're looking at about Richard Gale and I figured it up, 7 million employees. We actually counted every single current employee at Lockheed Martin, Northrop, all the major industries that supported Clinton. And it was about 5.2 million, just the military industrial complex, that would be impacted by her in a good way. And then we looked at the pharmaceutical industry, and we looked at other areas of that she supports. Why are none of these issues being discussed when it comes to this memo? Because I believe they are all tangential to it. The form is yours for the rest of the program.
Thank you, Gary. Let's pick up on your most recent points here. Those large six corporations that control our media also are heavily invested in what we call the arms trade, arms manufacturing trade, the thing that Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address. Now, I'd like to cite Pope Francis, who was speaking before Congress 2 years ago, and he said, you know, the main problem in all this is the blood-drenched arms traders. And all the congressmen and senators got up and everybody clapping and clapping. And if you look closely, you could see some of them looking into their vest pocket to make sure that the envelope from Lockheed, or the most recent one, Bracier, was still there. It was giving hypocrisy a bad name, you know? So this is at the bottom of this. There are a lot of people really profiteering. I don't say profiting, profiteering on the arms manufacture and trade. And many of those corporations are the same ones that control our media. So you mentioned GE, for example. They're heavily invested in MSNBC, right? So they build jet engines for fighter aircraft. And that's, you know, 70-80% of their business area. So they have this little MSNBC thing that maybe 10% of their business area, I'm guessing. And so are they going to let Rachel Maddow and anyone else say anything good about Russia? Of course not. I mean, tension, almost war, is very good for business. And the peace or a lack of tension, very bad for business. So the media is a major segment of the problem, Gary. And I say this every time I'm given the platform, and that is that in 55 years here in Washington, you see a lot of change. But there's one change that I've seen that dwarfs all the others in importance, and that is that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media. That is big. That could not be bigger. And you see them acting now with respect to the Nunes memo. There's a corollary to this, and that is there is a fifth estate. Okay, the fourth estate is moribund. The fifth estate, that's the ether. That's something that allows, by magic of some kind, real information to come into my computer early in the morning, very rapidly, I'm fed by all kinds of good friends. It's like being in receipt of the operations center at CIA. By 11 o'clock, I'm ready to write, or I'm ready to be interviewed. I'm in the same condition as I would have been at quitting time at Langley CIA headquarters, at 4:30, 5:30 in the evening. You mentioned Langley, and you mentioned folks that don't always tell the truth. You mentioned ghost things about the CIA. Well, I knew some of those ghosts. I started working there under President Kennedy. I met Angleton just once, but once was enough. Everything was a communist. I didn't want him looking under, but he was just really a really amazing person. And of course, he was tied with his umbilical cord to Israel. Nobody could write or say anything about Israel without Angleton formally approving it. Now, I have to sort of take one step back and indicate to people that when I came into that spanking new CIA building in 1963 up in Langley, there was an inscription on the wall, chiseled into the marble, and it said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And ringing in my ears was my Irish grandmother, who, if she said it once, she said it 100 times, "Raymond, be truthful and honest, and then you won't give a damn what anyone says about you." So I said, "Grandma, you know, if that's true, no pun intended, it's going to be a good place to work." And you know what, Gary? It was, because we were hermetically sealed off from the people that had no respect for the truth, no respect for the law. There were actual turnstiles in our building that prevented us from going to the operations people and from them coming to us. So all I can say is that for the first 20 years of my analytic experience with CIA, 1963, 1983, I could tell the truth, and so could my colleagues. Now, not always, but most of the time. That was the sort of modus operandi. When Bill Casey came in and brought, Reagan came in and brought Bill Casey and Bobby Gates, all of a sudden that all changed. And you got promoted on the basis of how swiftly you could salute when Bill Casey found 5 Russians under every rock in Nicaragua. And Bobby Gates found 7. And the division chief that was appointed to head the Soviet division, who knew nothing about Soviet policy, he saw 9 Russians under each rock in Nicaragua. Now, that's metaphorical, of course, but it's not far from the truth. So by the time I became conscious of this kind of thing, luckily I was offline. Luckily, I was in a job that I coveted more than any other job, and that was briefing the very top national security officials. We had gotten access to President Reagan when he was president-elect with the president's daily brief. Now, I prepared that under Nixon and under Ford, but we have had access. This time, we did. And so when Reagan came into Washington, when George Bush, George H.W. Bush, his vice president, said, "Now, how do you want to handle these briefings? You know, I'd like to be briefed, too." And I think the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, they should be briefed. "So what time do you want to have the PDB briefer?" Reagan yawned, and then he said, you know, now that we're here, I think maybe, you know, why don't we do it this way? Why don't you all get briefed at 8:30, you know, as usual, and come see me about 11:30 and tell me what I should be thinking about. Well, now, at face value, that's less good than seeing the president personally, but really it's much better because each one of these chief national security advisors had personal briefings on the PDB. Each knew the other what the other was getting, and I was alone, one-on-one, okay? The director of Central Intelligence was not peeping over my shoulder to make sure that I told them that I told someone that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. If I were asked that, I would say, well, my specialist friends who know about this say there aren't any, and then I would be fired. So anyhow, it's a long story. And the thing is that when our leaders started telling lies, like Richard Helms, okay? Now, he, at Kissinger's behest, he arranged the coup in Chile on September 11th, 1973. And then he denied that he did that under oath before Congress. Whoa! So Colby, who is an honest guy and a lawyer, and refused Kissinger's instruction to lie under oath before Congress, said, no, Helms did it. Well, Helms was tried. They let him off with a slap on the wrist to the so-called no-no contendere thing. He had to pay $2,000 or something. But the point of my story is this. He came back to a riotous, wonderful reception. It was sort of like he won the Super Bowl in the largest cafeteria at Langley. A couple of my analyst friends and I snooped in the background. Guess what? They passed the hat. They had $2,000 in that hat within about 30 minutes. And he was acclaimed as a hero. Why? Because he lied to Congress. Why? Because he wanted to protect the covert operation that overthrew Salvador Allende and brought havoc to that nice country of Chile. So what I'm saying here is that you have a group of people in our government, the operations part of the CIA, the operations part of the FBI, NSA, and now, my God, top echelons of the Department of Justice who feel that they're above the law. Now, people say to me, Ray, my God, you're saying that the Nunes memo is based on documents showing the top leaders of Department of Justice, as well as the FBI, lied to the courts in order to get permission to do surveillance on Carter Page and, by extension, all of his friends in the Trump campaign. How would they do that? Didn't they know they were going to get caught? And the answer, quite simply, is, hey, everyone knew Hillary was going to win, right? This was just sort of extra insurance so that they could get something on the Trump people and just make sure that Hillary did win. And who knew that she would lose? And, you know, if she won, there's no culpability. There's no possibility that she would move against these people because it was all to her benefit. And the DNC knew this was going on. Now, all that's going to come out in these documents. And when people say, oh, well, how about the Democratic rebuttal to the Nunes memo? And I say, yeah, bring it on. Let's see what it says. Because for the first time, we have evidence of real interference in the election of 2016. Unfortunately for the major media, it wasn't real interference from Russia. It was real interference from what we call the deep state, the highest levels of the FBI, CIA, and the Justice Department. So let it all hang out. Let's see what it says. This time we have documents. We ought to pursue them.
I heard a person who read the corresponding documentation from which the memo was written. So these are the originating documents. And he said that though he could not go into detail because they were classified, that there was no falsification of the memo, meaning the conclusions of the memo of who participated is accurate. So why are the Democrats, from Time to Mother Jones and The Nation to MSNBC and Rachel Maddow on CNN, why are they all saying that none of this is important when clearly these are the same people? If this was in the 1960s and 70s, they would have been the first to yell, look into these deep state because of Pentagon Papers, because of Watergate, because of May Lai massacre, because of Iran-Contra. They were the first. So what happened to the democratic institutions that are supposed to be looking after the truth and holding power accountable when now they're actually supporting these same agencies and these same heads of divisions?
Well, that's a very good question. And in among those people that you cited need to be added the very progressive people like Amy Goodman, like reader-supported news, like Common Dreams, like Bill Moyers, Now, these are all people that would repeat or recycle my memos instinctively, sort of automatically. I have been prohibited from being on Amy Goodman for 2 years, and no longer does Common Dreams, for example, or even Truth Out, publish my material. Well, why is that? Well, the simple answer that I choose is simply this. There is still a lot of PTSD here in this town. What do I mean? I mean that after the election, there was such a shock that Hillary did not win, that no one could think, no Democrat could possibly think that it was her own fault, okay? That no one could even conceive of the notion that nobody trusted her, or very few people trusted her, or that people really thought it was important to keep government secrets and not put them out in the unsecured email sort of thing. And other people thought, well, maybe she should have campaigned in those states that she needed to win. So it couldn't have been Hillary. Who might have been? Well, I know it was. It was the Russians. It was the Russians who interfered in our election. And what they did was contrive a legend. The legend went like this. A little chronology is necessary here. June 12th, 2016, Julian Assange of WikiLeaks announces that he has emails pertaining to Hillary Clinton and that he's about to publish them. Whoa. Okay, what happens? Well, that's only 6 weeks before the Democratic National Convention. My God. Oh, if he's got the DNC emails, he knows that Bernie Sanders was cheated out of the nomination very artfully by the establishment in the Democratic Party. Oh, my God, this is awful. What do we do? Here's what we do. We blame the release, if Julian Assange releases these things before the convention, we blame it on the Russians. And somebody says, well, but it's not the Russians, it's WikiLeaks. That's no problem. We get two for here. We blame it. We say that the Russians gave them to WikiLeaks, so WikiLeaks released them. And if they come out before the convention, that's all. We'll get the major media to focus on why the Russians did this. Instead of letting them read the memos and show how, pure and simple, the DNC in cooperation with Hillary Clinton cheated Bernie Sanders out of the nomination. So, you know, if you go back to the way this all evolved, if there's one prime mover of all this, I detest Trump's policies. I have 9 grandchildren who are not going to have clean air or clean water when they're my age. Okay, I think he should be impeached. Oh my God, not on a lie. So you have Hillary Clinton cheating Bernie Sanders out of the nomination. I think I'm not an expert, but I think he would have won the election. And so who's responsible for us having this clown, having this dangerous clown in office? Well, you go back to the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, all those people that quit as soon as the emails came out, and Hillary Clinton. Now, that's a big burden to bear. And that's why nobody wants to bear that burden. But if you look at how it all evolved, that's the way I reconstruct it. And I think that now we'll have the memos that show how the deep state, how the FBI, Comey approved these FISA, these Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act courts, the petition based on this phony dossier, which he knew is phony. He himself called it unsupported and scholarless. So he approves the application to get surveillance on Carter, on this guy Carter, who is a campaign worker. Now realize, it's not just Carter; it's everybody who's in touch with Carter, everybody who communicates with Carter, and everybody who communicates with those who communicate with Carter. So this is the two hop NSA standard. So everybody was monitored. And, of course, a lot of that stuff was leaked to the press. And so there was interference in the 2016 election. I'm sorry to say there was interference from the FBI Department of Justice and the CIA, to a lesser extent, NSA. That's what we call the deep state. And what's really interesting now is we have the pundits. We have pundits like, what's his name? Robinson, yeah. Here's the guy who writes for the Washington Post. What's his first name?
Eugene, here's the
headline Saturday. Trump has picked a fight with the FBI. He'll be sorry. Whoa. Now, we know that very early in January, that was January the 3rd, that Chuck Schumer, who is a real veteran, I mean, 15 years in the House, 15 years in the Senate minority leader now, he told Rachel Maddow, Rachel, you know, I used to think that Trump was a pretty smart guy, businessman, all that stuff, but he's made a very, very foolish mistake. And she says, what's that? He says, well, he's taken on the intelligence community, and they have 6 ways from Sunday to get back at you, so he said something really foolish. Now, my God, Gary, what does that mean? Is he saying that the President of the United States should be afraid of the intelligence community? Well, that's precisely what he's saying. And what did Rachel say? Did she say, oh, tell me about that? She said, well, I think we're going to break out. So that was the 3rd of January. On the 6th of January, these three people representing the deep state, the head of the FBI, Comey, the head of the CIA, Brennan, and the head of NSA, Rogers, present this fact-deprived memo saying, Alexander Putin himself interfered in the election by hacking, okay? And then, appended to that, Comey says, John Brennan and Rogers, would you just leave now? Because this is very, 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 you know, kind of sensitive. Then he gives Trump this memorandum, which claims that Trump was cavorting with prostitutes in Moscow, that he was lying in the bed where Obama and his wife slept while prostitutes urinated on the bed and all this stuff. And Comey gives this to the president. I said, no, Mr. President, this is very scurrilous. And we're not sure it's really supported by, but you know, the press is coming. We just want to let you know that we have this, Mr. President. Whoa. What's that all about? That's all about what the FBI does to incoming presidents. And we just want to let you know, Mr. President, that we have this stuff. If I were Trump, I would have fired him on the spot. Instead, he waited some time. And, you know, when he said the real reason he fired him, he said because of this Trump-Russia thing. Well, that was interpreted as trying to cover up ties with Russia. No, it was this legend that the FBI and the CIA created to make sure, number one, Trump could ever win, and number two, he'd be delegitimized as soon as he won, if he did win. That was the insurance policy.
Jay, Ray, we're out of time, but that reminds me of how J. Edgar Hoover would threaten everyone, not just the president of the United States, because he had tapes of JFK having sex with a Russian or with a woman who was also tied in with the Chicago mob. And he used blackmail for 48 years. And so it looks like blackmail is back in style.
Yeah, you know, in the mid-70s, when the Church Commission looked into this, that's when they created the FISA process. And it worked for the first couple of decades. Now it's not working at all. And getting back to JFK, you know, I asked Colleen Riley of the FBI, why could it possibly be that Robert Kennedy would approve those terrible things the FBI did against Dr. King? And she said, Ray, the FBI... Hoover has all those tapes about cavorting in the White House pool. So that's how it works, right? That's how it works. And that's how it's working now. The die is cast. The deep state might win this one, but only if they have the continued cooperation of the mainstream media.
And that, unfortunately, they do have because of who owns the media and all the other corporate interests and ideological interests. Ray, thank you for being on today and giving us your perspective on the memo.
You're most welcome, Gary.
Ray McGovern from Northern Virginia, and his website is raymcgovern.com. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.